get underway here with our fourth and final session of the Can You Believe It teleseminar. We've had, hopefully for you, 3 weeks of introspection as you've looked inside at the beliefs and that you've been carrying around for probably for a long time, gone through a process. First thing I want to do before we go into tonight's lesson, I want to keep the lines open. I'm not going to put anybody on group mute. And if you would, star six yourself, take yourself off of mute. Let's talk about your truth cards. Let's talk about what you encountered when you did that exercise, especially interested in maybe perhaps some of the statements that you may have identified, you know, how you came upon them. I'm especially interested if you've got an opportunity to use the cards all week, what type of response you had to that, or what type of experience you had. So before we get underway, who would like to be first tonight with their truth card experience this week?
This is Robert in Tallahassee. I just found it was, how can I say it, kind of, I guess it was a little trouble to kind of maybe reverse my thinking. It made me more aware of a lot of the negative thinking that I have, you know, all day long. It made me a lot more cognizant of it, and it made me, it was kind of hard. It felt like I was shifting gears, you know, and turning around. But I could see the value in it over time, you know, continuing to read them.
You raise an interesting point, and I'm glad you raised it. It will feel a little strange. You know, in our As a Man Thinketh study program, one of the exercises that we had was we just had all the participants in the next week coming up just take an everyday type function that they do, a habit, and, you know, change it. If they, for instance, one of the examples was if you comb your hair with your right hand, you know, for this week, comb your hair with your left hand. When you do that, you become a lot more aware of a lot of things you're not aware of because your subconscious is no longer directing you. It's no longer in control. Your conscious mind is. And you become aware of a whole lot more. And it is uncomfortable. So, Robert, you raise a great point. And that is, this process of changing your beliefs is going to seem a little strange as you implement it. It's going to perhaps feel uncomfortable. Because anytime you change anything held by your subconscious, obviously your subconscious is your automatic pilot. It just executes orders that have been stored in it. And anytime you go in and change those orders, it's going to seem strange. It's going to be a little different. So anything else, Robert?
That was the main thing that I noticed, you know. I kind of felt like maybe I was talking about somebody else at first, you know, but I'm getting used to it.
Well, I'm glad you had that experience because it is like you are talking to somebody else, quite frankly. I mean, your subconscious has executed orders based on the beliefs you've held for so long that there's no longer any thought involved in it. The responses you have are automatic responses, and that's what you're attempting to do. You're attempting to interrupt the automatic response and substitute a new response, a new belief, which is going to create a new response. And it is almost like it's another person. So that's you're on the right track. If you have those feelings, then no question you're on the right track.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go back and let's review the process that we've been through before we go into the final element of what pulls all this together. The very first week, you'll remember, we identified the source of these beliefs that we've carried for so many years. We went back and we thought of all of the limiting beliefs that hold us back in our life. We tried to identify whether that was the source of that was a parent or a teacher, a coach, a friend, a relative. First of all, the first thing we did, obviously, was we identified the belief. And then we identified the source of it. Then we identified the script that we have that we use to reinforce that. Then we identified the normal response to circumstances that we have as a result of holding that belief. And part of that process in the very first week was to create a new belief statement that was the opposite of the limiting belief. We want to change that limiting belief into a belief that has no limits, a belief that what I would call truth, because a limiting statement is never truth. We live in an abundant universe. I believe I said during week one, we live in a universe that the scientists, the smartest brains that we have in this world tell us that the universe continues to expand. The physical universe is expanding. So we live in a universe of abundance. There is no limits in our universe. We create those through our beliefs. So the diametric opposite of a limiting belief would have to be an unlimited belief, a belief in abundance. And that's, to me, the truth, because the truth is the universe is expanding. The truth is we live in a universe of abundance. So it must be true also then that things are unlimited. That is a belief that I can hold. That is truth. We also in week one, part of the exercise was to create and describe a mental picture of ourselves with the new belief in place. What would we be like with this new belief? You know, how would we act differently? What in the circumstances now we respond with the limiting belief, the opposite of that, how would we respond differently? What is the mental picture of us under circumstances responding now with a new belief in place? And then finally, as part of that lesson, we created a new self-talk script to support the old mental picture. If our long-held paradigm now, the limiting belief we have now is that we never have enough time, then we had to change that belief. We had to state the opposite of it. I always have enough time to get everything done I need to. That's my particular belief that I have, you know, inculcated into my belief system, into my values to address a limiting belief that I held. And then I see myself operating coolly under pressure. I always have enough time. I will get it done. Whatever I need to get done, I will have enough time to do it, and then I have to create that script to support it. And I find myself now, it's so neat because I've done it for so long now, that it's automatic. Anytime it looks like there's a time crunch, maybe someone else would look and say, oh, you're not going to have enough time. I know now automatically my response is you always have enough time to get done what you need to get done. That's my response. It's automatic now. That's the script that I use to support it. In week two, we went farther into the process, and we understand that in order to change, that first of all, that we learned that we think in images. That's how we function. And if we're going to change our beliefs, one of the first places we have to start is the images that we hold. But since we do think that way, since we process information, we don't process, words only create images for us. When we hear words, those words create images. It's the images that we process. Words are important. They're critically important, as we learned in week three, but it starts with an image. So we have to create a new image. And part of our week two lesson was to create a mental movie, a 30-second commercial, so to speak, that we were going to use to create impression upon impression upon impression upon impression of our in our subconscious of ourselves with our new beliefs in place. How, again, going back to part of what we did in week one, but taking it a step farther, how would we act? Just 30 seconds, and that was a minimum. Could be a 60 second, could be a minute and a half, could be a 5-minute movie if you wanted to create one that long, but a mental movie that we play. Another part of the exercise we had was surrounding ourselves with evidence of our prior achievements, because we discussed what it was like having achieved success at one point, having been in that state of mind, having held beliefs at that point that allowed us to experience some form of achievement, and that all we needed to do was to anchor into that as we went forward, that we proved to ourselves that we had been successful. And I think in the feedback that we got on that particular call was that people were surprised when they went back and looked that they had been successful in so many things, because they had discounted, as we tend to do with time, they had discounted what they had done. They had forgotten how much they had done. Another part of that exercise was to surround ourselves with images, evidence, images of the new beliefs that we wanted to create. And then we went into week three, and in week three, we're taking everything that we're doing image-wise, and we're going to support that with new verbal scripts. Now the words that we use when we talk to ourselves. So now we come into week four. We've got a process that will identify the beliefs, the limiting beliefs, a process to change those limiting beliefs by using imaging, by using our verbal scripting. And then we come in, and what ties it and what pulls it all together? I believe you have to have faith in the power of belief. I think in order to make this process work, first of all, you have to have faith, because, you know, belief and faith are very similar, but faith is acting in the absence of evidence. I'm not quoting this to get spiritual with you. I'm quoting this because it's such a great, great slice of wisdom from the ancient writer Paul, who said, faith is the evidence of things hoped for, the substance of things not seen. So it's faith is not something we see, not something we feel, not something we can touch. It's an action we take based on what we expect or what we hope for. So I think in this process, part of getting your beliefs changed and getting this whole process to work for you is stepping out with faith. So you have to have faith in the power of belief. Now, one way you have faith in the power of belief is through preparation. It is very, very easy to develop a strong belief in almost anything you want to have belief in if you will prepare yourself well enough for it to begin with. Go back to week one. In fact, my introduction into the power of belief, and I use the example of Roger Bannister doing the first 4-minute mile in the history of mankind. And I use that as an example because it was one of the greatest feats of history, because there were, for so many years, thousands of years, people did not believe it could happen. They did not believe the human body was created to do that. The community belief, the global belief, was that it could not be done. Now, Roger Bannister, you may or may not know, was a medical student. He went on to become a doctor. Roger Bannister had studied the physiology of the human body. And Roger Bannister realized from the study of the physiology of the human body that there was nothing about the human physiology that would prevent it from running the 4-minute mile. So, remember when the week we went out and we gathered the evidence? Well, that was some of his evidence. His evidence was his study of the human body. He proved to himself through his study of the human physiology that it was indeed possible that the human body could accomplish that. But that wasn't going to be enough. That wouldn't be enough to boost his belief, but it was a step in the right direction. Then what he had to do is he had to go out and prepare himself. He had to go out and practice. He had to go out and run. And perhaps he took a 4-minute mile. I don't know exactly what he did, but I'm going to guess that he probably took a 4-minute mile. He probably broke it down into smaller parts. He probably, you know, maybe started with a quarter of a mile or maybe even less. He broke it down into 4 parts. And he figured out, okay, in order to run a 4-minute mile, then I'm going to have to run at least 1/4 of it's going to have to be less than a minute. You know, in order to get under 4 minutes, you could run 3 at 1 minute. The fourth one's going to have to be under a minute, or the first one's going to have to be under a minute, and the other 3 can be a minute. But 1/4 of a mile, at least, was going to have to be less than 60 seconds. He knew that. So perhaps his training started at 1/4 of a mile, and he went out, and he trained, and he trained, and he trained until he could run 1/4 of a mile in under 60 seconds. He knew that if he could run 1/4 of a mile under 60 seconds, then it was a matter of putting 4 of them together, or 3 1-minutes and 1 under 60, and he'd have a 4-minute mile. So he had to go out and he had to practice. And then as he got where he could do one, then he took a 1/2 mile. Okay, in order to do a 4-minute mile, at least one of the 1/2 miles, okay, there's 2 1/2 miles in a mile, at least one of the 1/2 miles is going to have to be under 2 minutes. At least one's going to have to be a 1 minute, 59 and 9/10 seconds. So perhaps then he went out and he prepared himself by running and practicing until he could run a half a mile in 1 minute, 59 seconds. When he did that, he knew that all he had to do was figure out how to run the other half in 2 minutes and he'd have it made. So he broke it, he broke it down into smaller pieces, and the smaller he broke it down to, the easier it was for him to see that with some preparation that he could accomplish it. Now, a 4 minute mile might seem hard, but you break it down to a 60-second or 59-second quarter mile, and if you were if you were a runner, you'd recognize right away that a 59-second quarter mile is a whole lot more easily achieved than a 4 minute mile. But by breaking it down, he could get his arms around it. That's the first thing he did, and then the second thing he did was he practiced, and he practiced, and he practiced, and he practiced. Now, when Roger Bannister made the statement that he was going to break the 4 minute mile, one of the parts of his quotes was, "I have prepared myself." He knew he was going to run the 4 minute mile. Now, the day he went out, and he had attempted to do it before the day that he actually accomplished it, but he knew that he was going to do it at some point. He knew he was going to break the barrier because he had prepared himself. Number one, he created the evidence, which came through his study of physiology. And the second thing he did was he prepared himself. So if you want to take the beliefs now, the process we've gone through in the last 4 weeks, if you want to take and drive that home now, then you have to prepare yourself. Preparation is one of the most important things you can do to create belief in anything that you want to do. If you are attempting to create more time in your life, just like the example that I used with you earlier, about that being my particular challenge, that was a limiting belief that I fought, one, by the way, that I'd heard from other people and friends and family, and it's still here today. I still hear people say, "I don't ever have enough time." One of the things I had to do is I had to prepare myself. And what did I have to do to prepare myself? Well, I had to look at my life and how I was managing my time, and then I had to start changing some of the ways that I manage time. And I had to start prioritizing in my life, and I had to get disciplined. I had to prepare myself. The more preparation I did, the easier it was when I said to myself, my script, my new verbal script said, "You always have enough time, get everything done you need to get done." Guess what? The more I prepared myself by prioritizing, the easier it was to sell myself, the easier it was to convince myself. So the first thing you have to do is you have to prepare yourself. If you're prepared as you move forward from here, if you begin to prepare yourself, belief is going to become stronger and stronger, and it's going to come to you in waves, and you'll be amazed at how much your belief will change. And basically, isn't it just confidence? Didn't Roger Bannister just have confidence? And confidence, isn't confidence based on belief? So didn't he just have confidence? Well, you're going to have confidence going forward. You're going to have belief going forward if you're prepared. The second way to have faith in the power of belief is to understand that actions speak louder than words. And again, not to get spiritual with you, but just to quote a very wise saying from a book that I believe in, and it was from the writer James, who said, "Faith without works is dead." Well, we can take that and apply that to belief. You can say you believe in something. You can create all kinds of images. You can create all types of belief boards. You can create mental movies. You can do all these lessons we've done for the last couple of weeks. You can go out and create 1,000 truth cards. You can recite 1,000 truth cards, 100 times a day. If you do not take action, you will not create change in the subconscious. You must act on your beliefs. Now, it's scary to act on your beliefs in the beginning because, number one, you don't have experience. You're not quite prepared. Number two, it's new ground for you. You've never stepped out there. It's uncomfortable, no question about it. It's definitely outside your comfort zone. But let me just say this to you. And Laurel Langmire and I were on a call. I was on a call with her group on Tuesday night, and we were talking about the power of just a little bit of action. And I'll just tell you that my life has proven that if I'll just take a little tiny, tiny, tiny baby step toward anything, it's almost as if the universe opens up. It's almost like that's all the universe was waiting for before it began to bless me, before it began to open up with the things that I need to make my goal or dream or whatever become reality. And it works with belief beyond anything I can describe. What you're doing to your subconscious when you're trying to create a new belief is when you act on that belief, even though you might still be tentative about it, even though it's not automatic. You know, when you get up and you comb your hair, well, I used the example earlier in the call about combing your hair with the right hand and then changing over the left hand. When you get up and you comb your hair, or before, whenever you comb your hair during the day, it's so automatic you don't even think about it. It just happens. You don't think, okay, this is my right hand, I'm going to reach down, I'm going to pick up the brush, and I'm going to do this. It is automatic. You're thinking about something else. Your mind is somewhere else. You're not thinking about which hand you're going to pick that brush up with. It's just automatic. Now, to do it with the left hand, to consciously discipline yourself to pick it up with the other hand, that requires some thought. It feels uncomfortable, and it requires some thought. But understand that if you took that action with your left hand enough times, your subconscious would simply take that as a new order, and you would no longer comb your hair with your right hand. You'd comb it with your left. Now, guys, well, girls, I guess, ladies part their hair too. Some ladies do. Guys who part their hair would understand this. For many years, I parted my hair on one side because that's the way it was parted when I was growing up. That's the way my mother parted it. For some reason, I didn't like her parting my hair on that side. So when I got older, you know what, I'd had my hair like that for 18 years, and when I got older, I decided I was going to part it on the other side. It was difficult to change because I'd been parting it on one side. Stop and think if you've ever changed the part on your hair. It's weird for a while, but then guess what happens? It's not very long, and your subconscious has adopted it, and it's gone away. But you had to take the action first. You had to take that action to change it. That action sends a powerful message to the subconscious. That action calls on the subconscious, wakes it up, so to speak. All the alarms go off. You know, there's something going on here. This is not right. This is not normal. It's at that point in time when your subconscious is open to the new belief that you're trying to inculcate. So actions speak louder than words. You have to take action. Now, a part of the action is what is called the act as if principle. And many, many of the great teachers that I have followed, those that I have mentored under, those who I have never met but who are mentors of mine through their books or through their materials or whatever, some of whom don't live anymore. They left their work and, you know, we study their work today, but they're still mentors of mine. Many of them teach the act as if principle. In other words, if you want to change something, simply act as if you would act if that change were already in place. Act as if you have money. I used that as an example one time, and somebody wanted to know, you know, how, if you don't have money, how you can act as if you have money. Well, what came first, the chicken or the egg? See, there's the common belief that people that have money act a certain way that they do is because they have money. The fact is they have money because they act a certain way. And that's the part people get mixed up. Now, I'm not talking about people that, you know, that don't handle money in the right way, who perhaps have somewhat of a attitude perhaps because they do have money. I'm not talking about. I'm talking about genuine, humble people who have become successful because they practice the right principles. But they acted as if they had money long before they ever had it, or they wouldn't have it. So stop and think, if I had money, if this is your particular challenge, it may not be, but if you come to a circumstance in your life, stop and think, okay, how would I act if I had $1 million. In this very circumstance, I'm confronted with this problem. How would I act if I had $1 million? If you'll stop and think about that, you'll be amazed at how much different you might act. Well, if you'll begin to act as if you have $1 million, if you don't have $1 million now, you will, because you cannot act as if for very long before things begin to be attracted to you that will help you create that. And then over time, and it is a process, everything is a process, change is a process, you will acquire that. So a strong part of creating belief is the act as if principle. You want to help create a stronger belief in anything, act as if. My previous example about time. I act as if I have plenty of time. How do I do that? I very rarely ever rush around now. I'm not frantic like I used to be when I thought I didn't have enough time. Now stop and think about it. You've seen him obviously in public, and sometimes people in private aren't the same as they are in public. But you've seen Bill Gates in public. Does he look like a frantic person? Does he look like a person that would be pulling his hair out because he didn't have enough time? Does he look like a person who lives under a lot of pressure or a lot of stress that people that don't have enough time live under? No. You see Bill Gates, he's so calm, he's so vanilla that he's almost boring, you know, because he's just as cool and collected as he can be. He's just like a slow-moving river going down there, getting this job done, just moving toward its final destination. Now, both Bill Gates and me and you and everybody else on this call, we have the same amount of time every week, so if Bill Gates isn't there with all of his responsibilities, if he's not there pulling his hair out, and if he's not there all, you know, hyped up because he doesn't have enough time, then what about me? Why aren't I acting like him? Why aren't I acting cool and calm and collected? If I saw the other day they had the new list of the richest people in America, and he's number one. So if he's got plenty of time, and we've both got the same amount of time, both him and I both, then why does he act that way? And I'm frantic, and I'm running hither, running yon, and, you know, whenever you do that, you make mistakes. Whenever you do that, it actually costs you more time because you sometimes don't do it right the first time or you make a mistake or whatever. So act as if you have plenty of time. If you begin to act as if you have plenty of time, guess what? If for some reason now you don't think you do, you will very soon see in your life all of this time suddenly appear. All of the things that you need to get done will get done. So we've said, first of all, you got to prepare. Second of all, actions speak louder than words. Third, use the act as if principle to strengthen your belief. And then the fourth thing is be alert to all the new evidence that your beliefs are changing. Be alert to all the new evidence that your beliefs are changing. When you see the truth cards beginning to work, when you see your new visual imaging, your new mental movie beginning to work, be alert to that because you want to do two things. First of all, you want to celebrate it. You know, find some way to reward yourself whenever you are in the process of changing a major belief. Celebrate. Your subconscious likes that reward. Reward yourself for your change in belief, and your subconscious will take that and reinforce, which is step number two. When you see the evidence, reinforce the new belief. Okay, I've been acting as if I have plenty of time. I can feel like my beliefs are changing in that area. And then today, I actually experience it. I'm in a crunch time at work, and I've told myself my response now is I do have enough time, and here it is. I finished. FedEx picked it up. I didn't get upset. I didn't get nervous. I didn't get anxious. FedEx picked it up. My proposal will be in their hands tomorrow. And guess what? I look down, and there's still 30 minutes left to go in the day. Oh, I've got plenty of time. I always have enough time. When you celebrate that, so maybe you leave early that day, or maybe you do something else to reward yourself, and then you reinforce. at that moment, when you recognize that, you say, I always have enough time to do everything I need to get done. You reinforce when you spot that new evidence, you reinforce that the belief has changed. These are things you need to do after you've done the process that we've been through the last couple of weeks. Now, if you're on the call tonight or if you're listening to this later and you haven't had a chance to keep up each week, that's okay. Just don't skip any parts of the process. Each part of the process is important. It's kind of a building block. You have to start kind of at the bottom and create a foundation. So these are building blocks. So you don't want to start in the end before you've done some of the things you need to do in the beginning or in the middle. So this process, and you can begin this process at any time. You can begin this process all over anew again tomorrow. You can go back to week one, and you can start tomorrow. You can come home tomorrow and say, here's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to get a more thorough, or I'm going to create a new list of limiting beliefs. I'm going to spend some time introspection, and I'm going to create a new list of limiting beliefs. I'm going to identify the source. I'm going to identify my scripting. You can go through that whole process at any time. I would encourage you to do that on a regular basis, because the last part of the process that I would suggest to you as we wrap up this part of the evening tonight is that you need to make a commitment to continue your progress in your personal development. Change is a process. You know, it was the position you find yourself in today. And, you know, we go back in the week where we celebrated our past achievements. There's good and there's bad. You know, there's many, many achievements in our past that we need to recall, but at the same time, we also have to understand that this place that we find ourselves today, the negative circumstance that we find ourselves in today, we came to that over a long period of time. There was a process to get us here. There's a lesson we have to learn now. We learn that lesson, and the negative circumstance will pass away. If we change our beliefs at the same time in the process of that lesson, we can assure ourselves that not only will we not see that lesson again, but that our life will take a much better turn for good. It will turn in a direction toward a better life. So we have to make a commitment that we are in a regular program of personal development, personal growth. If you're not a reader, if you're not reading 15 or 20 minutes a day from a personal development book of some kind or a biography of a person who you want to emulate, then I'll just suggest to you that's not negotiable. If you study the life of anyone who's achieved any type of success in conquering themselves, in mastering themselves, in mastering their beliefs, if you read the biography of anyone that's done that, I'll just challenge you to find one that wasn't a reader. Everyone I've ever known about, everyone I've ever studied were readers, and most of them were prolific readers. They read all the time. You know, Mark Victor Hansen, the brains behind the Chicken Soup of the Soul series, you know, they've sold, 70 or 80 million books. That guy is a phenomenal reader. He carries around a bag of books. I mean, he carries 25, 30 books around with him all the time. He's just a reader, voracious reader, avid reader. You know, Laurel and I were talking about Bob Proctor the other night. Bob Proctor's one of the brightest people I've ever met. The guy's a high school dropout. But he reads so much now. He's educated himself. He's grown. He's just so knowledgeable on so many topics. But he's a voracious reader, tremendous reader, loves to read. If you don't like to read, then what I would encourage you to do is take a course, because you probably don't read fast enough or you don't comprehend it enough. You know, we may offer one in the future. We're trying to get one. We have one that we would like to offer that we might be able to offer in the future. But it doesn't matter. Don't wait on us. Go get some other type of reading course that will help you improve your speed if that's what discourages you. Or if you have a problem comprehending, get a course that will improve your comprehension. But whatever you do, find some way that you can discipline yourself on a regular basis every day to read either 15, 20 minutes in the morning, 15, 20 minutes in the evening. That's how I can assure you, Charlie Jones, Charlie Tremendous Jones, who I had the great fortune to meet again and spend time with out at the Jim Rohn event. Charlie Tremendous Jones is the reason I read As a Man Thinketh. We wouldn't be on the phone tonight if it wasn't for Charlie Tremendous Jones. Super guy. Here's what he says. You are the same today you'll be in 5 years except for two things. The people you meet and associate with and the books you read. You're going to be the same as you are in 5 years, same as you are today in 5 years except for two things. The people you meet and associate with and the books you read. The books you read are what's going to change your life. The people you meet and associate with over the next 5 years are going to change your life. Adopt a habit, reading every day, and I promise you, you'll see some visible changes very, very quickly in your life. So back to the power of belief. We have to have faith in the power of belief. We have to have faith in the process. We do that by, number one, preparing. Number two, take some kind of action. It doesn't have to be very much. I was using the example with Laurel the other night that I now know that when I'm overcome with a new idea and I get excited about a new goal or, you know, something I want to take on, I know that what I have to do. All I have to do is make one phone call. It doesn't matter, almost it doesn't matter to whom, but as long as it's about that goal, all I got to do is make one phone call. And it's all of a sudden things begin to happen. The wheels begin to turn. When I make one phone call, things begin to happen. I may get an email or someone else may call me or I may get something in the mail or I may bump into somebody. Things begin to happen in my life that will make it even easier for me to take the next step. If you'll take one step, what is it they say, the journey of a lifetime begins with one step, or journey around the world, or whatever it is, the old saying, but you know the saying I'm trying to recall, just that one step. Action speaks louder than words. If you're going to change your belief, you're going to have to take action. Third principle, act as if. Fourth principle, be alert to all new evidence that your belief is changing. And the fifth principle, continue your commitment to personal development. Okay, we're going to open up the lines now for questions and answers, and this can be about this week's lesson or it can be about any of the other week's lessons. This is our last opportunity in this part of the session to exchange information. You got comments, you got observations on the process, or you got challenges. It doesn't matter. This is your time now, so I'm going to take everybody off of a group mute.
You said act as if, you know, you are, like, for example, if I want to have, let's say I want to have a lot of money. I act as if I'm a millionaire, okay? I mean, do I go spend like a millionaire?
Well, wait a minute. You're assuming that millionaires spend. See, that's the false assumption, is because you're assuming that millionaires spend. I'll just say this, that if you want to become a millionaire, and I'm not picking on you or anything like that, and this may not be what you want to do, but since you use it as an example,
yes,
I'll follow through with the example. If you want to be a millionaire, let me just encourage you to go to Amazon, and you can buy this book used at Amazon very cheaply. Go buy the book called The Millionaire Next Door. And it was written by Dr. Thomas Stanley, who's a professor at Georgia State University. It's called The Millionaire Next Door. And what that book's going to do is he did a study. This is a PhD who did a significant, legitimate study of millionaires. And what he determined is millionaires, we got the wrong idea who is a millionaire and who's not. Most millionaires, you'd never know it because of the way they live. They don't live the flashy life, the spendthrift life that we assume they do. You know, the Robin Leach and the Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous is what gave us the impression that millionaires are out, you know, lavishly spending. But that's not true, what he found in his study. So, you know, the if you acted as if a true millionaire, first of all, anyone who has money that keeps it doesn't spend money foolishly, doesn't spend money, they may spend money lavishly celebrating, or they may spend money lavishly at times, but I mean, $1 million is not that much money anymore, to be honest. It's not what it used to be, for sure. So I mean, you could go through $10 or $20 million, going out lavishly spending it. You could go through $10 or $20 million fairly quickly. In fact, there's lottery winners all over the, you know, all over the place who don't keep their earnings. I mean, they go out and they'll win the lottery, and then there's many, many stories now, and true stories that have been documented of lottery winners who won multi-million dollar pots who today, you know, don't have a pot to, you know what, you know, so...
Well, the reason I raised that question is was basically I wanted to get a little bit of details of how to. I mean, it's not the millionaire situation. Okay, fine. Everybody wants to get a millionaire. Million is not a lot of money anymore. But I'm saying is what I meant by that is basically what are the steps to take? How do you act like it? You know what I mean? Like what do you have to do? Do you have to read books of what millionaires are all about, for example, things like that, and act like one? Or
absolutely, I'll just tell you that book that I gave you will be a good starting point in terms of some practices that you can adopt. You know, first of all, I'll tell you that most people who have accumulated money have a regular savings plan of some kind. Now, it's not going into a passbook savings account. It's going into a more sophisticated investment account. But everyone who has money, you know, legitimately, not someone who you know, may have inherited it or got it in a settlement or won it in a lottery, but everyone who legitimately has money, and believe me, the statistics are the people who keep it are the ones who got it legitimately because they got it with principles. And they accumulated it. And most of those who accumulated it, the vast, vast majority, accumulated it through some type of plan. So if I were going to act like a millionaire, and I looked at my life and I see that I'm not setting any money aside every month, then I'm not acting like a millionaire. Right? So if I'm going to act as if I'm a millionaire, I've got a new program. And that new program is that I'm going to pay myself first. Okay? Read The Richest Man in Babylon. Dennis Waitley talks about it. Brian Tracy's very big on it. All the great teachers teach it. Pay yourself first. Okay? You say, but I can't. I don't have enough money. Well, you won't ever have enough money if you don't pay yourself first. Pay yourself first. Even in the beginning, even if it's not 10%, it may only be 1%. But if you'll take the action, remember we said that one way to change our beliefs and to reinforce that is to take action. So here's what I'm going to do. You know, I can't set aside 10% of my salary right now, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pay myself first 5% every month regardless, even if it hair-lips the governor. And you'll be amazed at what will happen just by that little tiny action. And if you get... you know, start celebrating as you see your belief change 2 months from now, 3 months from now, 6 months from now. And I was on a call the other night, and this was brought up. The lady said it's been amazing. It's been amazing because she had never done that. And now after 6 months, she begins to have some belief that maybe, really, she can accumulate some wealth. That's just the first step. There's a lot of things you have to do, obviously, to become a millionaire and accumulate wealth. But guess what? You have to start somewhere. So if you take action, even the tiniest action, 5%, okay, you say, I can't afford that, 2.5%, 1%, a half of 1%, take some kind of action, act as if you were a millionaire. What would they do? They'd pay themselves first. Act as if a millionaire, whenever you go to buy something, do you buy something of good quality, or are you motivated only by price? Most people who have money buy quality. It will surprise you that most people, in Thomas Stanley's book, most people and the millionaires that he studied don't buy new cars. They don't buy new cars because they don't like depreciation. They buy cars that have been barely used, but they're not brand new because there's a depreciation taken away right away from the time they drive it off the lot. That's the way. So you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Now, I'll just give you an example from my life as I was beginning to think, you know, acting as if I had wealth. And one thing that I did was I heard this was not my technique. I'm not nothing that you hear from me is anything original. I've learned all this from someone else, put it into practice, tried it in my life, it worked, so now I teach it. If it didn't work in my life, I don't teach it. If it worked, I teach it. And one thing that I did, I heard someone say this one time, and so I tried it, was, you know, this was a time when I didn't have money hardly. You know, I'd run my gas. I'd run out of gas. I didn't have money to keep my gas tank because I wasn't thinking right. But at some point in that process, I decided to start acting as if. So I decided, okay, if I were, if I had wealth, then I would always have money in my pocket. I went down to the bank. And I got a crisp, brand new $100 bill. And I had a money clip that someone had given me. And it wasn't a fancy money clip, but it was a money clip. And I took that money clip and I put that $100 bill, brand new $100 bill, in, and I might have two other, you know, bills in my possession at the time, but I put that $100 bill in there. Now here's the thing. I decided that I was always going to have money in my pocket, and I was always going to have at least $100. And so I would, my goal was never to spend that $100. I just wanted to have it. I wanted to feel like I always had money. This was a time, again, when there wasn't a lot of money in my life. But I had to convince myself, I had to change my beliefs about it, that I did have money. And having that $100 bill, always knowing that $100 was in my pocket, had a definite impact on my belief. Now, sometimes I might have some other bills and did have other bills. It might be a $20, might be $40, might be $60, but I always had the $100 and I would never spend it. It didn't matter what happened. It didn't matter if it was down, that was the last bill. I never spent it because I always knew I had enough money. I always knew I had that $100. It'd get ragged with age. I'd just go to the bank. Next time I'd go to the bank, I'd say, would you give me another one of these? Would you exchange this? Guess what, folks? I still do that today. The difference is now I've got a gold money clip, and in that gold money clip, many times there's been, in fact, I had that gold money clip stuffed one time with hundreds so big that it actually sprung the money clip. Now, again, that's not about me, and that's not about bragging or anything. I'm trying to make a point as to where you can take an act-as-if principle and how far that act-as-if principle can go if you'll put it in your life. If you'll start acting as if you would act, if you already had it, it will not be long before you will, because you'll be acting with the right principles. Now, you have to, again, act and change the belief, act as if. You have to be acting in the same principles. It'd be very helpful to the caller who asked. It'd be very helpful to know, if you want to be a millionaire, how they act. Because if you just act as if you perceive they might act, being spendthrifts or whatever, spending lavishly, then obviously you'd be acting under the wrong principle. So, but it works. Act as if principle works. It works in anything you apply it to. You want to become a good speaker? Act as if you're a good speaker. You may be terrible. You want to be a comedian? You know, there's untold stories of celebrities who use the act as if principle. Movie stars of all types. Whatever it may be. You want to be good, you want to become great at something, act as if you already are. Do the same things that you would do if you already were. And when you begin to adopt that mental mindset, you will become that. How would a great salesperson act? If you're in sales and you want to be, and you don't consider yourself to be very good and you want to be a great salesperson, study a great salesperson and discover what they do and how they act and begin to act that way. Even though you're not there yet, act that way. Act as if, and you'll be amazed. We got time for one or two more before we wrap it up.
Yeah, I got a question.
Okay.
This is Kevin.
Yeah.
My question is, other than trying to find a millionaire and figure out how he acts and so forth, how can we research and learn how they really behave and to how they walk and how they, you know, the things that they really do, so that you can try to mimic one as good as possible?
Well, first of all, I would give you the same advice I gave to the previous caller. Go buy the book, Millionaire Next Door.
Yeah, I did, and I read it.
Okay, and what did you take away from it?
Like exactly what you said.
Okay.
They're real thrifty.
Okay. So, you know, do you have some examples in your community?
Of millionaires?
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of.
How big a town do you live in?
It's huge.
Okay, well then there's huge numbers of millionaires in your town.
Right.
What you need to do is ask around. Did you go to a college?
Yes.
Okay. Big college, small college?
Kind of small.
Okay. How far away are you from the college?
About 2,000 miles.
Okay. What you're going to attempt to do is you're going to attempt to create a relationship with a mentor. And one place that I encourage people to start is to take, if they went to college, is to take their alumni directory or somehow get alumni information about people who went to the same college and locate someone in their area that went to your college. Now, first of all, let me just tell you why. There's a natural affinity. We are open to someone who attended the same institution that we did. You know, even if I don't know you, if you went to Florida State University, you and I have a kinship from the very beginning because that's where I went to school. You may have gone 20 years before me. We may have gone at the same time and never met each other. It doesn't matter. But we have a kinship. You may be Democrat or Republican. You may be the opposite views of me on many things. But we have a natural kinship because we both went to the same institution. And that it's very common. So, you know, if I were looking for a mentor or a model, then I would be looking for a Florida State alumni in the area who is successful. I've watched him or her from afar. I know how they operate. I've watched their businesses. I admire their businesses. I admire their role in the community. I admire what they do. I admire the kind of person that they are, that they're humble. I admire that they're always willing to help other people. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick up the phone and I'm going to call the person and I'm going to tell them, hey, this is Vic Johnson, and I understand you went to Florida State. Really? Great. Well, I did too. Yeah. Hey, I've always admired what you've done, and as an old Florida State alum, I'd like to buy you lunch one day next week. And you'll be amazed how often people will take you up on that offer. And you'll be amazed at how willing that people, successful people are, truly humble, successful people. You'll be amazed at how willing they are to share of their success. And, you know, what I have taught is find a way that you can help that person. Find a way that you can be of service to them. Now, you can't be of service to them in the field that they're in. You can't help them in that field. They're already successful. I've used this example before. You know, Michael Jordan, I just love to watch him play basketball, and I heard that he might be coming back to the NBA. I hope he does. There's nothing I could teach Michael Jordan about basketball. Nothing at all. It's a joke. He's the master. I couldn't help him at all in basketball. I have no benefit to him at all. But I have talent in other areas that Michael Jordan doesn't have talent in. For instance, I have talent in the marketing area that Michael Jordan doesn't have. I have a lot of talent. I'm not as good in marketing as Michael Jordan is in basketball, but I have a lot of talent in marketing. And I could help Michael Jordan in the marketing area. And so I could bring something of value to Michael Jordan that would be of help to him. And so what I say is serve. Find a way that you can serve someone else. Find a way that you can help them. Find a way that you can fill a need that they have. And if you're willing to serve for a long time sometimes, not always, but you may have to serve for a long time before you ever get a benefit returned to you. But if you're willing to do enough sowing, you'll be amazed at how much you can reap. But that's how you can create relationships with mentors and potential mentors. Number one, find a kinship, okay? Perhaps if you play golf, you know, if you belong to a particular club, maybe you need to go join another club. Look at the people that you're associating with, and if you don't find the type of people that are in your club working in the ways that you want to work, that have the principles and values that you have, go join another club. If you are aware of someone who in the community or a group of people that you'd like to work with, find out what organizations they work with and go volunteer. The way that I got started in political campaigns 24 years ago was I volunteered. I volunteered in a campaign, and guess what I brought to the campaign? Marketing. They didn't have any, they needed marketing help. And I brought that to the campaign. And I literally left my business I really didn't, but I was away from it so much that it was like I left it. But it was a very short campaign, as most of them are. And I spent, the better part of 2 months in working in that campaign without a dime, no compensation at all, no promise of any kind. There was no big cushy job waiting on the other side. I'm just out there, pouring out my heart and my soul and using my gift, my talent, and I'm out there giving it away, giving it away, giving it away. Well, we won an upset victory. It was a surprise. We weren't supposed to win. It was one of the biggest victories in the state of Florida. That was 24 years ago. And because of that, it launched me into what became for me for a while a career, and a very successful career for a while. But I worked for nothing and gave it away in 1980 as a volunteer. It exposed me to some people that I wanted to be around. It put me in touch with some people that I wanted to be around. 2 years later, 1982, there was another election season coming up. I went and gave my services away, my marketing services again. People found out about what I did in 1980. They wanted my help, and I went and gave it away again. It was 1986. 6 years later, before I ever made a dime from a political campaign, 6 years later. But then, within 4 years after that, I was making a middle six-figure income from political campaigns. So what started out as me giving away and serving turned into be, for a while anyway, not a long period of time, but for a while, a very, very prosperous deal for me. So if you're looking, to find someone to model in your community, especially if you live in a big community, there's all types of examples. Find someone, study them, read the newspapers, ask your friends, ask your pastor. In fact, if you go to a church, I promise you that in your church, if it's a church of any size, there's going to be some successful people in your church who are super successful, who are humble about it, and I'm sure your pastor will know who they are. You may already know who they are. Just look at all the existing relationships that you have now and look for the people that are in that you deal with now or you come across now, and then once you identify them, figure out how you can serve them and what might be a good way to open the door. Again, if it's you can use the college alumni way is a great way to open the door. Go volunteer in an organization that they're a leader of or a part of is another great way. If they're president of the United Way, go down and volunteer for the United Way campaign. You want to get close to somebody, go help them. You'll get close to them. Trust me. That help?
Well, that helps a lot. I just had one more question. That is, in the book, The Millionaire Next Door, they talk about how most millionaires are just ordinary folks and you wouldn't even know that they were millionaires. So, I know people who have nice houses and nice cars, but I don't know that those are the people I really want to be working with. And so I guess I'm leaning towards how do I find the right people?
Well, first of all, you may have to get out into your community yourself and get some more exposure in order to, determine who the people are that you'd like to model or mentor. you know, you're just because someone, you know, has a nice house, you know, or whatever, doesn't mean they have money, obviously. Obviously, many times that someone who does have a nice house has money. Once you get out into the community and once you're active in organizations, you're going to be able to determine that. And let me just give you an organization right now and tell you, whether you want to be a speaker or you don't want to be a speaker doesn't matter. Find out where your local Toastmasters, and you've got one, I guarantee you, probably have one meets in the morning and one meets in the evening and maybe even one meets for lunch. And this would be for everybody on the call. If you've never been to Toastmasters, just go join your local Toastmasters. And here's why. 65% of people have a fear of speaking. There's no purpose for that fear. We weren't born with that fear. That fear was a belief, a limiting belief that came along at some point in time. We stood up in class and the kids laughed at us. We stood up and we spelled a word wrong and the teacher chewed us out, or, you know, for whatever reason, we developed this distaste for public speaking. There is it's almost impossible to achieve any significant level of success without being able to present your ideas in a confident, comprehensive way to other people. Toastmasters will give you the confidence and the belief that you can do that. When you have that confidence and belief in one area of your life, it will spill out and spill over into other areas. What it will also do is it will introduce you to some other people who are progressive, who are growing, who are into personal development. Through those other people, you will be able to identify some of the types of people that you're trying to find. But that I would just recommend, you know, you may not want to be a member of the Rotary Club, which is a great organization for people. You may not want to be a part of any of those. That's fine. But go join Toastmasters just for what it will do in terms of building your belief in yourself, and also in terms of what it will do in terms of networking. The association thing is just so vitally, vitally important in your achievement. You know, and I'm not saying dump your friends. But my guess is you take your friends, the handful of really close friends that you have, my guess is that they make the same amount of money as you do within 10% plus or minus. They probably live in a house, you know, valued plus or minus 10% of the house that you live in. Birds of a feather flock together, that's true. Now, if you want to achieve at a different level, you got to go find a flock of birds, and usually there's fewer birds in the flock. You got to go find the flock of birds that are achieving at the level you want to achieve at. You don't necessarily have to give up your friends, but you need to learn to network and to associate with people who are achieving at a level that you're not achieving at. And there's all kinds of ways to do that. These seminars that, like the Jim Rohn seminar, the one coming up in November, Laurel Langmire, Bob Proctor seminar that we're doing in San Francisco, that's why we encourage people to get to those, is because you get around that flock of people who are achieving at the level you want to achieve at. But your association, if you're not active in your association, you know, identify the leaders in that, the people who are achieving in that. Get close to them. Find out what they're doing. You know, I was on the phone today with a guy who just gave me a list of contacts because I'm networking with him. He gave me a list of contacts that I could have never developed. I would have never figured it out. I'd have never found out. You know, and just by developing a relationship with somebody, I was able to kind of get some insider information, perhaps. But you got to create those relationships. So that we kind of got off the topic of can you believe it, but it is all relevant. It all relates. It all goes back to the same thing that, you know, you're not going to ever attempt to do anything that you don't have belief that you can achieve. You're not going to give 100% to it. You're not going to step out there and do it. That's what this has been about these last 4 weeks. I have, you know, tremendously enjoyed being with you. I'd go another 5 hours tonight, you know, if we could, because this is important stuff to me, as I hope it will be with you. And I wish you all the best of success, and hope you have a pleasant good evening.